All right, everyone. So my name is Ray Potter. I'm sorry for the maybe the confusion from your programs. I'm not sure what happened to the session that was supposed to be here, but the folks from Tizen called me up on Friday and asked me to present today. So what we're going to talk about is security, and we're going to talk about a little bit about cryptography and basically building security into this type of environment, right? So we're not going to go through all sorts of cool, source code demonstrations or anything like that, or demos, frankly, because we didn't have that much time. But it's going to be kind of a basic general overview of security and some things to think about when you're developing applications or developing for the platform. So just before we get started, just kind of a poll: like, is anyone here familiar with information security or deal with it on a daily basis? Awesome. Okay, so you guys can keep me honest. Everyone else here to just learn or a little bit disappointed that you didn't get the stack development one? Hopefully you get some good information out of here, because one of the things that I find with security is that it's always an educational process, and as we'll talk about, it's always seems to be an afterthought, right? So I'm always happy to kind of evangelize certain ideas and certain concepts. But anyway, so for today, I mean, we've got a few things that we're going to talk about, but I'd like to make it interactive as well. I mean, we have a small enough group. I think we probably could have done this at the bar downstairs, but I would like to hear from you all. I mean, especially the InfoSec practitioners, and even not, just some thoughts and concerns you might have. We've got some cool little things to throw out for audience participation, and I've got a bag full of them, and I don't intend to carry them home. So if you want a cool football, just raise your hand. Ah, oh, nice. Who says security and cryptography can't be fun, right? Okay, so what we're going to talk about, can everybody hear me okay, by the way? Okay. I tend to yell, and then when I'm mic'd, I just blast everyone's eardrums. So let's talk about a couple of use cases for information security and cryptography within kind of wearable and IoT environments. I'd like to talk about some technical constraints, some risks and some challenges that I'd like you all to think about and that we're thinking about. We'll discuss some similarities to mobile environments. So there's a distinction between wearable and mobile, I think, and we'll kind of draw some of those out a little bit. And then, like I said, I want to just leave you with a couple of techniques to think about in terms of information security while you're developing for the platform. So a little bit of overview about us, just so you know who I am. So SafeLogic provides cryptographic modules that really focus on compliance and regulatory compliance, right? So we do all the hardcore, nerdy crypto stuff, but we do it in a way that meets different regulations for healthcare, for finance, for government, et cetera. Company's been around for a little over 2 years. We kind of started really digging into the mobile space when crypto was relatively uncharted, I think, in that environment. So we started kind of addressing a few problems there. And frankly, we kind of see some of the same issues trending within the IoT and the wearable space. So that's why it's actually kind of cool to be here. And by the way, if anybody wants copies of the slides or whatever, just hit me up afterwards and I'll hook you up. One of the things that I'll also mention while we're doing this is that, I mentioned we do crypto modules, but we're also running, pilots on different wearable environments, right? So we've got a build that's for the Gear Watch, for Google Glass, all these other things, right? So if there's something of interest to you, if you're looking to maybe explore building in some strong crypto into your applications or into your products, just come up to me afterwards and we'll talk about that. For the newbies in information security, it's a very complex, very broad, and very deep field, right? But, excuse me, I think there's three main concepts that you want to think about that really just about any security solution, feature, et cetera, really ties back to. The first is confidentiality, okay? So if you think about what confidentiality means, it's basically ensuring that information going from one party to another is not disclosed to someone who shouldn't have that information. So think about all the hot topics of encryption nowadays, right? So this is basically protecting that information so that no one else can read it, right? It's crazy how all of a sudden in 2014 and encryption's cool again, right? it was so nerdy for a long time, and after all the stuff last year with Snowden and NSA and everything and RSA security, all of a sudden now everyone's thinking about it, which is kind of fun. The second is integrity, okay? And this is making sure that information in transit or at rest or what have you is accurate, it's authentic, and it's complete, and it's unmodified. Okay, and we'll talk about some use cases there. But a quick one, if you want to think about the importance of integrity. So confidentiality, we talk about encryption. Integrity, a use case there is something like, if you want to think about a bank wire transfer or something like that, you want to make sure that the account numbers aren't modified between points. You want to make sure that the amounts aren't modified between points. And there are certain ways to do that with certain cryptographic functions. Another concept is availability, which kind of seems weird because, why is this a security issue, right? If I can't get to a server, is that a security issue or whatever? Well, you've probably heard of the concept of denial of service attacks or what have you. Well, there are certain mission critical systems that if aren't available do pose a information security threat, right? And especially if we're looking at in the context of military or battlefield or something like that, it really does become a security issue. So there's a few others, but these are really the three main areas of information security that you'll want to think about as you're building your products. So a couple of use cases for security, and this is where I think we can start to have a little bit of fun and hear from you guys. So information security isn't really just about, government is getting all the attention nowadays and a few other ISPs and things like that, but it really can apply to just about any field, right? So one of the things that we're always talking to is, if we're talking to a developer that says, I'm just writing software for doctors. Why do I care about encryption? Well, there's a whole list of reasons why you write. So, one example, if we're talking about from a healthcare perspective, the reason we're concerned about security, encryption, all this stuff is, as people are moving to wearables and Internet of Things, the use case I like to draw is when a surgeon is using Google Glass to record an operation, right? All of a sudden, now they have patient data sitting on a device. Well, according to HIPAA regulations and all sorts of other things, that information has to be protected, right? Because it's associated with an end user, with a patient, and it's considered personal health information. So, that's something that a lot of developers I don't really think are thinking about in terms of general compliance. But what are some other things if we're talking about corporate or retail or transportation? Anyone has some other ideas of types of information you want to protect and why security is important, especially on a wearable? It can be crazy or as outlandish as you want. Yes, sir.
Porn surfing happens.
Oh, nice. What is this porn you speak of? I'm just kidding. That's good. So privacy, basically, and possibly data protection and malware protection, things like that. That's really good. So if you're in a corporate environment, you'd want to protect that. Exactly. Yes, sir.
Inserting incorrect data, false data, misdirecting stuff like if you have sensors that show location, that's going up to a server someplace.
Right.
That's tracking your kid.
Mm-hmm.
Or some other asset.
Exactly. You must have read ahead because I'm talking about that in a second. Oh, I way overthrew that. A couple of others for. I'm sorry?
The child abduction purpose.
Sure.
I mean, theoretically, your kid's got to wear somebody could fall for
it. That's exactly right. Or track it or somehow manipulate the data, make the parents think that they're home when they're not, and that's very good. Oh, my gosh. I got to work on my arm. Fortunately, you have a reach. So, there's all sorts of examples, right? There's tons of them. The challenge that we have is condensing strong cryptography, condensing all this stuff into a somewhat limited model, right? Usually when we're looking at cryptography, we're talking about servers, we're talking about, you know, racks of systems, we're talking about, you know, custom-built appliances, we're talking about things that have, you know, multi-core processors and all sorts of crazy things. Well, when you're looking at a watch, you know, there's only so much you can do with it in terms of processing power and space and capabilities, right? Performance is an issue as well, because, you know, I think everyone is, you know, wants everything now, right? Now. And if you're kind of running some massive crypto operation, it's going to slow down your app and, you know, possibly disrupt some user experience, right? Which no one wants. You know, also proliferation of devices, proliferation of platforms always poses a challenge, right? Because all of a sudden now it's not just Windows, Mac, and Linux that people are developing for. It's those plus, you know, plus Tizen, plus iOS, plus Android, plus, well, not really Windows, but some people are. Maybe Microsoft is. But, you know, there's so many different devices and operating systems and forks and branches and things like that that pose a challenge to, you know, the information security community, right? Firmware changes, all of that stuff. So one of the things that was interesting, though, you know, I say that these are challenges, but when we were going through and building our solution on the Gear Watch and for the Glass, we were actually pleasantly surprised. I mean, we had to do some pretty aggressive bit slicing to take it from the, you know, the iOS and Android model down to the watch. But in terms of, you know, performance numbers and things like that, we were actually pleasantly surprised. I think our biggest challenge was space, because we want to make sure that if an app developer is incorporating our solution into their app, they're not going to run up on space constraints, right? So we want to try to keep it small for the developers.
Well, when you say space, you mean RAM?
Yes.
Okay.
Just RAM, memory footprint, all of that stuff, yeah. That's exactly right. So, you know, there are a lot of constraints out there, but like I said, it's proven to be, I guess, a little bit more positive than we initially thought. Excuse me. So, in terms of what's at stake, especially on the wearable side, there's a huge risks, right? So going back to kind of our initial talk, pattern recognition, like that gentleman pointed out, that's huge, right? If someone's able to track where you are with your wearables, they know you're not at home, right? If they have, you know, links to other family members, oh, they know no one's at home. And then all of a sudden they go in and hack into your Nest and they say, oh, Nest is on away mode, so now we know no one's home, right? So I think there's this kind of snowballing chain reaction effect of pattern recognition that we need to think about. Identity theft as well. I mean, the more information we have and the more places, the more subject it becomes to being compromised, right? So whether you're trying to use, I don't know, NFC for payments or something like that, it's just something to be concerned about, because now all of a sudden we've got our identity is everywhere, because that's what we want. We want people to know what we're doing and where we're going and what we're thinking. Corporate espionage is obviously a huge one, right? Companies don't want to lose intellectual property. They don't want to lose competitive advantage in any industry, right? Whether it's mobile, whether it's wearables, whether it's utilities, right? I mean, we were talking to a company that essentially makes refrigeration for you'd be surprised, but basically for grocery stores, things like this. And you'd be surprised at what competitive advantage they're trying to seek. Another one is the diaper industry. Crazy, right? You would think, all right, everyone just makes diapers. I actually toured one diaper factory. It is so locked down. It's more locked down than literally some data centers I've been into. It was crazy. They had full biometric scanners. They had all sorts of things because the competitive advantage was so important to them, right? And then the scariest one is loss of life, right? And this applies in a couple of different contexts. It applies in, you know, a military environment, of course, right? I mean, you know, compromises in security or information can lead to loss of life, which is, you know, the absolute worst case. Healthcare as well. So as you start to think about connected devices and, you know, being able to control your pacemaker from your watch or whatever, well, you know, that poses an interesting concept where someone could basically, you know, muck with someone's pacemaker and do some really bad things. It's just scary stuff, right? And usually as a security practitioner, I'm not the type that preaches FUD or anything like that, but it is scary to think about because it is so personal now, right? I mean, now it's not just, oh, someone compromised my credit card, now I've got to clean up all that stuff. Now it actually gets really serious, in my opinion. So, yes, sir?
Dick Cheney had his wireless pacemaker removed.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody would kill him wirelessly.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it's a real threat, and I think it becomes more and more doable, as devices progress, as they get more connected. It is pretty scary. So, mobility, right? So I mentioned a second ago, I think in terms of wearables and Internet of Things, security isn't really being thought about. It's not really being practiced, and that's okay. It never is as part of a new paradigm or a new technology or a new platform. But I'm hoping we can learn some lessons here because as mobile platforms started on the rise several years ago and people are bringing their phones to work and accessing corporate data and corporate email, all of a sudden people are thinking, oh crap, I've got to protect this stuff, right? Because it's no longer my device. So I don't know how closely you all follow that space, but all of a sudden, 90 MDM vendors popped up, right? Mobile device management vendors. So these are the companies that make sure if you're taking your iPhone into work that, you're not accessing the camera to take pictures of stuff, or your email's somehow locked in some secure container that can't get penetrated from outside, or you've got dual personalities, dual personas, what have you. So this was a crazy industry, and it was a reactive industry, right? It was like, all right, well, people are bringing their phones into work. Now we got to think about this. So I think we're going to see the same thing here, sadly. I mean, as much as we can try to say build security in and think about it, it's not glamorous, first of all. It doesn't help sell product, and it's a cost center usually, right? It's not a feature ad. But what I'm hoping is that with all the security and encryption awareness that's been, I think, proliferating over the last 6 to 8 months, I'm hoping it becomes a little bit more predominant. So in terms of some lessons that have been learned on the mobility side, like I talked about, mixing personal and corporate data is just huge, right? There were cases where people were bringing their phones into work and taking pictures of sensitive documents that couldn't be emailed, right? I know of one company that was compromised this way, right? They had very sophisticated data loss prevention technology within their network, right? That prevented a particular user to send documents out to a Gmail address or what have you. But what happened with this company is someone took their phone into work and took pictures of it. That's all I needed to do, right? So for that reason, people started saying, oh, well, let's use this concept of geofencing to say if someone's bringing their iPhone into work or their Android phone into work, well, as soon as they cross into the thing, the camera's disabled, right? It's cool stuff, but, still, people are going to find a way around it. There's all sorts of vulnerabilities out there, whether it's, malware, whether it's a malicious user. I mean, it's hard, but, again, I think the lesson learned on the mobility side was that it's very reactive. So what can we do about it? Really just, build security in. Think about it early on. And again, security is not all cryptography, right? I mean, even though that's what we focus on, that's not that at all. It's access control, it's auditing, it's information protection. It's so many things that are frankly not that easy to understand, right? Or even more to the point, not that easy to do correctly. So there are some tools and some techniques for doing that. One is basically a concept called the security development lifecycle. Has anyone heard of this? Nice. Someone raise your hand. They're getting a football. Go. First one to do it. Go. So the security development lifecycle is actually pioneered by Microsoft, right? Boo, hiss, all that stuff. But this is something they actually did right. They did pretty well. So what happened was when they were getting hammered by the industry over flaws with 95 and XP and all those other things, they basically took a step back and said, okay, how can we more proactively address security, right? And it took them a number of years, but there's some charts that show that it was very successful. But what we've seen is that it's actually grown as a concept. And there's certain ways to do it, right? And we've seen a lot of different companies adopt the model. Not necessarily the same model as Microsoft, but it's basically adapting secure development to whatever life cycle you're in, right? So, you know, whether it's, you know, Adobe or EMC or Cisco or Juniper or Symantec. I mean, I know tons of companies that are looking at this sort of model, right? So if you're curious about it, just read up on Microsoft SDLC, Secure Development Lifecycle. It's actually pretty interesting. And a good way to learn about a lot of different, you know, secure coding practices, threat modeling, all that good stuff. Another thing to think about is security validation and validation of, you know, crypto functions, of security functions, et cetera. So validation is a concept where you have a third party that comes in and says, okay, I have looked at your code and I think that, yes, it is implemented properly and securely and according to some standard, right? And we'll talk about that a little bit more right now. I guess just with time, there's so many things we could talk about, but I just wanted to mention a concept of FIPS 140 real quick. Has anyone heard of it? Yeah, a couple people? Awesome, you did. Sweet. Oh, we got two more footballs. I have to do a Hail Mary at the end. So FIPS 140, the reason I bring this out is it touches a lot of different areas, and I think it's useful for folks to know. What it stands for, it's Federal Information Processing Standard 140, and it's basically a requirements document for cryptographic modules, right? It's developed by U.S. NIST and also by the Canadian CSEC, which is essentially their NSA, and it's actually a published standard. And what it is, it's basically a set of requirements for any cryptographic module, and it covers key management, it covers self-tests, it covers roles and authentication, you know, all sorts of areas like that. And its purpose is basically as a requirement for procurement within federal government. Okay, there's a couple of good use cases that I'll mention about it. I guess one benefit of FIPS 140 is that it keeps you using standardized and known good implementations, right? So instead of using Joe the intern's crypto algorithm or Joe the intern's hashing algorithm that he, you know, that he read about in college or whatever, it actually prescribes the use of, you know, formal and industry recognized algorithms that have undergone sufficient cryptanalysis, et cetera, right? So you know they're known, you know they're good. And there's a way to actually go through and test to make sure that they're implemented properly, right? So if you've heard of, you know, everyone's talking about AES now, which is Advanced Encryption Standard. And if you go, you know, out on the show floor here or anywhere else, everyone's gonna talk about AES-256, right? All that is an encryption algorithm that they're using to protect information, right? So FIPS 140 recognizes that as an industry standard and actually encourages is the wrong term, but not only does it say, okay, so you're saying you use AES, check. What it does is it checks to make sure that you're using AES properly, right? Which is pretty crucial because crypto isn't always easy to implement, right? And we've seen a lot of cases where people will, you know, not necessarily do it correctly. And it doesn't necessarily lead to compromise of their system, although it can. But one example is in the routing and switching space. We worked with a vendor that was having interoperability issues, and it was because they had their, you know, algorithms implemented incorrectly, right? So there's all sorts of little things that you know, can serve an example. Yes, sir?
Did the NSA compromise RSA suite pass FIPS validation?
So that's an interesting one. So the gentleman here asked if the NSA compromised the RSA suite past FIPS. Yes and no. There's a couple, here's how that whole thing allegedly happened. I say allegedly just because it's the right thing to say. In the FIPS 140 process, there's basically a committee that will go through and approve standards for use in FIPS 140, right? So as new standards are being discussed, developed, you know, all this, the folks at NIST will go through and look at it and say, okay, is this something that we want to use within federal government? Well, NIST doesn't necessarily have the bench for doing cryptanalysis, right? So sometimes they will bring in the NSA to help, you know, digest algorithms, make sure that there's no backdoors or anything like that. Well, what happened with the NSA, with the RSA security stuff is this. Basically, the NSA was championing a way to develop random numbers, to generate random numbers, because random numbers are very important when you're generating keys or something like this, right? I mean, it really comes down to, you know, how random can something be so that it's not probable to attack. Well, the issue was that the NSA engineered this algorithm in a way that it could be backdoored, but was not obvious to anyone, you know, other than because they're such brainiacs. I mean, if anyone looks at the standard, it's like, oh, okay. And so it was a published standard. It took years for someone to actually realize, oh, there's an issue, right? So what happened with RSA was they said, okay, well, this is the new method for generating random numbers. I'm going to adopt this by default. So they put it in all their products, and then all of a sudden, now, yeah, exactly. So that was the issue there, right? So that's actually been stripped out from the approved algorithms, and you know, I think they've you know removed it from their products, et cetera. But yeah, there's always issues like that that happen. But you bring up a good point in that you know someone using a FIPS validated module could still potentially be compromised, which is just crazy. So there's concepts of you know being FIPS compliant and FIPS validated. There actually is a process by which you go through and get a formal FIPS certificate that says I've been through all this rigorous documentation and testing and source code review and you know things like that, and you actually get a certificate in your name that's highlighted on a government website. Reason for doing that is a couple. You know, one, it reassures your buyers, right? So you're not just saying, yes, I do AES 256. You're saying, yes, I do AES 256, and it's been blessed by you know this organization. Another benefit is that, frankly, it's required, right? So if you're selling product into federal government, certain cases in, well, it's recognized within healthcare and finance. It's not necessarily required, but it is a nice checkpoint to have. So you know, it's that reassurance, but it's also a you know a discriminator. From a consumer perspective, nobody cares, right? I mean, it's hard enough getting consumers to understand, you know, not to leave their passwords on a post-it note attached to their monitor, right? They're not gonna go through and understand, you know, all of this stuff. But it's a start. We've got about 5 minutes left, and I know everyone's probably fried from the week. But yeah, I just thought we'd open it up to some questions or comments or, you know, praises or whatever. Yes, sir.
Have you done any research on the new Intel prototype boards, Galileo or
We have. So our challenge, not very well.
A little bit.
So actually this gentleman might be able to explain it better than I can. Do you want to give a quick overview of it for
what should I explain?
Galileo.
What they are.
Yeah, what they are.
Okay, so Intel in the last 6 months or so has developed on a mass scale a technology which is kind of intended for enthusiasts and small companies and hobbyists to promote the Internet of Things. So it's an Arduino compatible. You can plug in the Arduino shields, things like motors and LEDs and so on. It's a small baseboard with a system on a chip, which is called the Quark. And it's very low power and intended to embed on things like drones which fly in the air or later clothing, things like that. And you create things on a hardware level. It's a very open platform and it runs Yocto Linux or something like that, and people are trying to get Tizen on there.
Much better than I could have done. I basically would have said a tenth of that. So we've run into it a little bit. So in short, we're doing a couple pilots on it, but nothing to really disclose or announce there yet. I threw you one, right? Huh? Did you get a football?
No.
Oh, well, there we go.
Is it the last?
No, there's one more. Okay. I keep digging deep.
He gets the last one.
No, I've already got one.
You've already got one. Yes, sir.
Okay. So if we think about security in the mobile phone space and so forth, like rewind 4 or 5 years, and then now as we're going into IoT and wearables, people think, oh, I just have to do what I did in the phone space, and IoT and wearables. So from your perspective, what's different? What is IoT or wearable developers, what things do you think are assumptions that we can just lock down on top of that, and then what new things do we need to think about if we move into the IoT wearable space?
Sure. Very good question. So basically, the question is, what do we need to think about in terms of, you know, more lessons learned from mobility and applying it to wearables and Internet of Things? I think the threat landscape increases dramatically, right? I mean, we're going to have to think about, you know, everything. You think about the use case of a car, right? If I've got a connected car, is someone going to be able to all of a sudden hit the brakes or hit the acceleration, you know, stuff like that, right? The threat models for Internet of Things and wearables becomes huge, right? And I don't think, so when I was talking about like the SDLC, it's going to have to apply to specific use cases and specific technologies, right? So I think it's mobility times 100, right? Because with a mobile phone, like I said, the threat model is pretty considerable. I mean, in terms of email and, you know, information compartmentalization, all this other stuff. But in the IoT space, it's going to be things that we never thought of, and, you know, including people in the security industry. It's going to be like, oh crap, you know, we didn't think about that. So so I think that's the short answer, is just the threat model just gets ridiculous.
Have you looked at things like the black phone?
Yes. Yes.
What do you think?
I think it's a cool concept. I know there's a couple people who have been working on something similar. The question was, have we looked at the black phone, which is basically meant to be a secure device? If it is what it says it is, fantastic. But, you know, again, there's so many threats and there's so many points of entry and things like that that I really don't believe anything's 100% secure. I think it's a step in the right direction, and I know there's a lot of folks that are looking at, you know, similar types of, you know, whether it's secure messaging or secure phone calls or what have you. There's different ways to do it, but there lie other challenges of, you know, where is all this information stored, whether it's a text or whether it's a phone call, right? Is it stored within the U.S.? Is it stored, you know, in Canada? And what are the you know, the lawful intercept rules there, right? So I mean, there's a bunch of different concepts, but I like that people are thinking about it. And I think it's cool. And I think it's super expensive too, right?
Relatively.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, the FBI are buying lots of them.
That's right. Any other questions, comments? Yes, sir.
What do you think it would be the workaround for security measures involving the IoT? Meaning that every time that there's a user involved in the security, like we're inputting a password or something, there's a vulnerability because they're common users, usually.
Mm-hmm.
People that know what can be lost when, I don't know, putting your password in the market or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what could be the workaround for the Internet of Things? You know, if you can control the car with your mobile device,
yeah. So shoot, that's a really interesting question. I tell you what, if you can solve that, you will be famous and wealthy and all that stuff. And get a football, that's right. That was my best throw of the day. So on the subject of passwords, that's a challenge that a lot of people are trying to solve. And there's all sorts of cool ways that people are trying to augment passwords, replace passwords, all that. But you're dead on. I mean, if there's a single point of entry to your IoT ecosystem, yeah, you've got to be careful, right? So in terms of, is there a workaround? Not really. I mean, there's all sorts of cool, like I said, options for like dual factor authentication, which is basically pulling an authentication from a couple of different areas, right? So not just a password, but maybe a password and a fingerprint. So someone enters a password, they enter a fingerprint, you can be reasonably sure it's them, right? But again, the challenge with security is that it's difficult, right? The more you secure something, the more you lock down something, sometimes the harder it is for a user to, from an experience perspective, right? And we've all seen that from the corporate side, right? Where it's like, oh God, it's the first of the month, I've got to go through and change my password again, you know? And just different situations like that where, you know, it's a huge challenge. So, you know, the workaround is kind of a balance between technology but also usability, right? And there's, like I said, there's always going to be some compromise. Like, nothing's going to be 100% secure, but you got to just tailor it to the risk profile, right? So what's the actual risk of someone hacking my phone and getting into my car, or hacking my phone and getting into my house? Probably pretty good if you lose your phone, or if, you know, what have you. So, you know, you have to start thinking about it from, you know, different concepts, right? So if a user loses their phone, how can they make sure that they're somewhat protected, right? Or, you know, I think there's just different ways, but that's a very, very, very challenging problem, which I wish I could answer. All right, what time is it? I think we're about good. Thank you all very much. I'm sorry for the swap on the agenda, but hopefully you got something good out of it and learned some things. If you have any questions or anything like that, if you'd like to talk further, you can hit us up there. My email address is ray@safelogic.com. So anyway, thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Enjoy the rest.